Welcome, everybody. I'm Richard Krause. I hope you're doing well, staying happy, healthy, and safe. Later on in the show, we're going to meet best-selling author Dolly Alderton. She's a regular columnist for the Sunday Times Style magazine and the author of the phenomenally successful memoir Everything I Know About Love, which she's just finished making into a hit BBC television series. She's also a best-selling novelist thanks to her barnstorming fiction debut Ghosts. Today we talk about her latest bestseller, Good Material, a story of heartbreak and friendship and how to survive both. That's a little bit later on. First up, let's meet Dominic Monaghan and Billy Boyd, a.k.a. Merry Brandy Buck and Pippin Took from the Lord of the Rings trilogy. They've built upon their famous friendship by working together on podcasts like The Friendship Onion, Moriarty, The Devil's Game, television shows. Billy Boyd appeared on Monaghan's travel show Wild Things, and they've just announced a new reality series, Billy and Dom Eat the World. But right now, they're making their stage debut together as a different kind of dynamic duo. The pair will star in a new production of Tom Stoppard's Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead in Mervish Productions' Off Mervish series at the Toronto CAA Theatre until March 24th. It's about two minor characters from the play Hamlet who suddenly get pushed into the foreground and they don't know what's going on. And we'll see all the bits from the play Hamlet that we don't normally see during the run of the production. Dominic Monaghan and Billy Boyd join me from their theaters backstage via Zoom.
Gentlemen, we do not stop till nightfall.
What about breakfast?
We've already had it.
We've had one, yes. What about second breakfast?
Don't think he knows about second breakfast, Pip.
What about elevensies? Luncheon, afternoon tea. Dinner? Supper? He knows about them, doesn't he?
I wouldn't count on it.
Billy, tell me a little bit about going back 20 years. You first discussed Rosencrantz and Guildenstern with Dominic while you were on the set of The Two Towers. What was it about the show 20 years ago that made you think it would be good for you two?
You know, I was trying to look back 20 years now, 25 years. Dom and I spent a lot of time in a giant prop of tree beards, you know, the Ent, the walking tree.
Yeah.
And so we'd be up the top of there and its branches, and they had to hook us in for safety. And it was a real hassle to come down. So when they stopped for a tea break, if it was only 50 minutes, 20 minutes, we'd say, we'll just stay up this tree, just give us a cup of tea up, you know. And so we started discussing lots of stuff. One of the things was the idea to do some theatre together at some point. At that point, I think I hadn't long after read Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, so it was kind of fresh in my mind. And I thought, oh, that's a great way. It's one that's always stuck with us. You know, it's not just comedy. It's not just for laughs. There's a lot more to it.
Well, Dominic, I think that's one of the reasons that it has lasted. It was irreverent at the time. People weren't really playing around with Shakespeare in that way at the time, I don't think. But since then, it's been imitated so many times. How do you keep it fresh?
For me, at least, it's important to not be looking at what's been done before. You know, I know Billy and I both have not necessarily looked at the film anytime recently, and I wouldn't necessarily go and see another performance of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern while I'm doing this play. I think you have to try and make it your own to a certain extent. And obviously you bring, you know, the entirety of yourself into a role. So that is going to influence the way that you play Rosencrantz or, you know, the other people play their parts. It is, of course, brilliantly written. And the more you lean into that text, I think that's where you find, you know, a lot of the comedy. But in terms of originality, the only thing that you can think that bring that is unique to the project is yourself. So you have to, you know, bring that as much as you can.
And Billy, I think that the chemistry that you two have from a relationship that dates back for a couple of decades and the podcasts and the television shows and working in films together goes a long way to creating something that will be unique within the framework of what the show is.
Normally you get one actor and another actor and they may know each other, but they haven't had 25 years of going on vacations and spending Christmases together and doing shows together. And so, yeah, that's definitely something special that we bring to this, is we sort of accidentally bring 25 years of a relationship to these guys who have that sort of relationship.
Yeah.
So it's that makes it very a special production, I think.
Yeah, Ian, we were lucky enough to hang out with Ian McKellen relatively recently, obviously.
I wanted to ask you about this. Yeah, tell me what he said, because I read about this and I think it's really interesting.
Yeah, he had just said to us how much of a great idea he thought it was. Obviously, there isn't that many things that Ian hasn't done in the world of theatre, and his experience in theatre is pretty profound at this point. And he just made mention to us that one of the great challenges with Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead is to try and convince the audience that these two people know each other so well that they can be kind of quite physical with each other. They can ask challenging questions. They can be vulnerable around each other. And he said half of the rehearsal process is usually taken up with kind of bonding between those two actors and making sure that they're confident enough around each other.
You're listening to Dominic Monaghan and Billy Boyd on The Richard Krause Show. See them in Tom Stoppard's Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead in Mirvish Productions' Off Mirvish series at Toronto's CAA Theatre until March 24th.
Billy and I don't need that. Of course, when we were rehearsing in Halifax, we did go for dinner. We did spend time with each other, which continues that kind of bonding experience. But it's like Billy said, it's 25 years in the making. And Ian was quite effusive about the fact that he thought that the play is going to really benefit from the fact that we are real life friends.
I think that one of the reasons that this show has endured and has remained popular over the years is because it's about really primal stuff. It's about life. Mm. It's about death. It's about questions we all ask ourselves. Who are we? And tell me a little bit how you would break it down. For someone who's never seen the show before, what would you tell them to entice them to come see it? Other than having you two starring in it.
Exactly, which is the number one draw. it's just a lovely idea, I think, from the playwright to say, okay, here's a play, maybe the most famous play ever, Hamlet, and here's two characters in it. What happens when they're not on stage? If we make this a reality, this 3 hours of Hamlet, what happens when they're not on stage, when they don't have anything to say? They don't have a history, really. They have the kind of history that actors do when they try to build a character. Who says what about me? What do I say about other people? What's real and what isn't? And, where does it start? Where does it end? It's such an incredibly smart play, as well as being, I think, really funny.
Yeah, if we do it right, it's supposed to be funny.
Between your characters that people would know from Lord of the Rings, you've kind of switched the character traits of those characters, of Mary Brandy Buck and Pippin Took, to Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. You've flip-flopped them. I guess that was intentional. Is it geared towards playing against a type that people might recognize you for?
I'm more enticed by going on the more arduous road at work. I think it's more interesting to me to be challenged to do something that is harder naturally to do. Mm-hmm. I think you could put a strong argument forward to say that classically Mary and Pippin can be defined by the fact that Mary is constantly trying to work out what is going on, and Pippin seems to be much more happier in the not knowing of what's going on and just being safe. Those would be classic kind of character tropes of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. So maybe, although I'm not sure, but maybe it would have been easier for me to play Guildenstern, simply because I played a character that has more Guildensternian kind of traits before. But I thought, and Billy was very responsive to this, I thought it would be much more of a fun exercise to play the opposite and maybe learn a little bit more about how Billy approached Pippin and how I approached Merry. And I would think we would have missed an opportunity if we'd have done it the other way around, because I've been really having so much fun watching Billy have some of those kind of challenges and emotions that my character in Lord of the Rings had, and vice versa. There's a great line that Rosencrantz says in the play to Guildenstern, which is, "Be happy. If you're not even happy, what's so good about surviving?" And that feels very much like Pippin to me in The Lord of the Rings. He's just like, look, we're safe right now. We've got a flagon of ale and we've got a meal in front of us, and let's just enjoy this moment.
Do you ever go back and have a look at Lord of the Rings? Those films have taken on a life of their own, but I wonder, you were there. Do you ever go back and have another look?
Sure, my son has never watched them. He's 17 now and just about to finish high school. And he went on a skiing trip with some friends, and they all watched the first one because one of the guys there was a big fan. Then when he came back from that trip, we watched the second one together. And then now we're trying to figure out if we can see Return of the King in the theater, because he wants to finish it the way it should be seen. Mm-hmm. And I think he's right. Yeah. So sometimes Return of the King pops up in a theater and we'll go off and see it there.
That was Billy Boyd and Dominic Monaghan of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead by Tom Stoppard, which is playing at the CAA Theater in Toronto until April 6th. If you're not in the Toronto area, never fret. You can always check them out in Lord of the Rings, the trilogy. It's on Blu-ray, it's on DVD, not hard to find, and it's really fun and really good, and they're both great in it. Let's meet best-selling author Dolly Alderton. She's a regular columnist for the Sunday Times Style magazine and the author of the phenomenally successful memoir Everything I Know About Love, which has just been turned into a hit BBC television series. You also may have read her best-selling book Ghosts as well, which was her fiction debut. Her latest bestseller, Good Material, A Story of Heartbreak and Friendship and How to Survive Both, is in fine bookstores everywhere right now. The book, which follows stand-up comedian Andy as he tries to process his breakup from his girlfriend Jen, is a tale of heartbreak and friendships packed full of the author's trademark wit and sharp observations. Dolly Alderton joined me via Zoom. You say, writing is how I understand life. Tell me how that is. Tell me how you process things.
It's just this reflexive thing that I've been doing since I was keeping diaries when I was about 5 years old. But it's not enough for me to just experience something once. I have to put it on the page, and I have to analyze it on a page, or fictionalize it on a page, or make fun of it on a page, or find, imbue it with a meaning on the page that I couldn't in real life. And yeah, it's the same when I hear something funny or when I hear something profound. My friends just know now that when they say something particularly brilliant, that I'm just looking for an excuse to go to the toilet so I can write it on my iPhone note. And they all know that now, and they're fine with it. And a part of that is like that writer's cannibalism that we all have, that we're always looking for copy. But another part of it is like, I think there's something in me it's about kind of wringing the flannel of life a bit. That's what writing is for me. It's like, it's not enough that you've told me this funny story. I have to go write it down and read it over and over again. And then I want to put it in something and try and see if I can make it even funnier. There's just something about, it's obviously my career and it's obviously my passion, but it's so existential for me. It's how I translate the experiences of life.
Well, do you think that part of that comes from having been a columnist or being a columnist? And when you are a columnist, I did it for 15 years here, you have to have a constant flow of stories and ideas, and you just start looking everywhere. Everything around you could be an idea for a story. And okay, I began to find that kind of cumbersome after a while. But tell me how you feel about it. Do you think the two are related, or have you always been that way?
No, you're so right. They definitely are related. I always remember that character Mark in Nora Ephron's Heartburn, who obviously would have been based on Carl Bernstein, that he, a sort of vocal tic, he was a columnist for Washington paper, the character, and his wife, Rachel, comments on the fact that he has this vocal tic that just ends up driving everyone crazy, where he would just say, I think there's a column in that. like everything that he saw. Like, is there a column in that? Yeah, I mean, that is definitely, you will know better than anyone doing it for 15 years. I've only been doing it for 10 years. And luckily, my column now is an advice column, so I don't have to come up with ideas. It's the coming up with ideas that is the really cumbersome part of it. But I think what it does do, there's a reason why I think Nora Ephron went from being a reporter to being a memoirist, well, novelist memoirist, to then being a screenwriter. I do think that beginning a writing career as a journalist or as a reporter or a columnist, I think it is a fantastic discipline because I think it makes you observe the right things. I think it makes you hyper observant and a sort of maniacal collector of things because it is your métier. Like, it is how you're making money, is you have to find something every week. So I think it does something to your observational eye. And I think to just gathering material. And I also think that discipline of just you have to hand something in. You know, I still have it every week when my column is due on a Wednesday. And when I'm on a deadline for something, for novels or for a script, sometimes, you know, when it gets past Wednesday, 3 o'clock, my lovely editor Priya will start messaging me being like, hi, just a reminder on this. Yeah. Hey, just a nudge on this. Hi, we are getting your column today, aren't we? And it's like, I don't know. I think it's quite good as a writer to have that sense of you have to meet this deadline. There is no question of writer's block. You have to meet this deadline.
Oh, deadlines are the only way that I get anything done.
Zadie Smith once said the best time to edit your book is 5 minutes before you're about to go on stage and do a reading. that's when your editor should say, can you hand in your edits now? Because you sure as hell will have a clear idea of what you do and don't want.
Let's talk about good material. Tell me a little bit about the inspiration for the book.
Yeah, it's a bit of a departure from what I've written before. And that was a very conscious decision.
You're listening to Dolly Alderton on The Richard Krause Show. Her new novel, Good Material, is available wherever you buy fine books.
Going back to your question about how being a columnist or being a journalist influences writing fiction, something that it has really given me is a thirst for research and a fear for research. You know, like, you know, when you're doing an interview with someone, when you're a journalist, you have to become a connoisseur in something overnight. Mm-hmm. And I feel like, I remember when I was a features writer, I would be writing about, like, I don't know, the plumbing system for the Olympic Park for the 2012 Olympics. And then for a week, no one in the world would know more about London's plumbing system.
But you're only an expert about these things for the week.
Exactly.
Right? For the time that you're working on that story, you know everything. And then afterwards, for me anyway, it all...
totally gone.
Yeah.
Exactly the same. And I think that has done, and also like the big fear, you know, I trained to be a journalist. I did a master's in journalism. We did a module on the legalities of reporting. And the biggest fear in journalism is like not doing your research and, you know, getting facts wrong. So I think what that has given me is, yeah, this craving to research characters and research worlds. And obviously so much of writing fiction and writing screenplays and writing scripts is about imagination and empathy. But for me, you know, when I was making my TV show, my exec producers just used to be boggled by the fact that I had a character who worked in retail at a specific British shop. And I got in touch with the British shop and I spoke to a woman who had worked at the shop for 40 years. And I did a call with her because I wanted these details. I wanted to imbue the character with this research, and I like the process of research. So I wanted to write about something so far away from my own experience. I wanted to write someone with a different job from me, different gender, different personality, yeah, different background, different you know, part of England that he grew up in. I just wanted everything to be different to me, and I wanted to research it and imagine it, and it was so enjoyable to understand the world of comedy, to understand the world of men and male friendship. and yeah, I really enjoyed every minute of it.
Well, you say, I've always been mystified by men, and I've always had an interest in decoding them in both my brain and on the page. So I suppose that's what you've done here.
Yeah. See, look, you're a good journalist. You've done your research. yeah, totally. And I like that tradition as well. You know, I'm rereading Pride and Prejudice at the moment. And I like the Bennett girls being at home trying to decode and understand male behavior. And that's something that everyone loved about Sex and the City. That's something that everyone loved about Bridget Jones. There's a franchise at home called, I don't know if it ever made its way over here, called Angus Thongs and Full Frontal Snogging. It was like,
that's just a great title.
It's really good. It's like a cult book for teenage girls that just lives in all of our hearts, which is about a teenage girl kind of trying to understand teenage boys. So I wanted to do that, but I wanted to do it a different way. So instead of it being, you know, like I did with my last novel, where it was a woman who's ghosted out of the blue, and then she spends the rest of the novel kind of trying to solve the mystery of why did this man do this, and why do so many men seem to keep doing this to people I know? I didn't want to write about from that point of view again. I've done it so much. So I thought, well, why don't I do it? Why don't I get closer to the subject? Why don't I assume a male narrator?
He's got sort of a desperation about him a little bit, I guess a quiet desperation about him a little bit. Tell me a little bit about creating him, building him, because he's very specific, and he has to be. But tell me a little bit about creating him.
So I did my research. I interviewed 15 men as part of my preparation in forming Andy and imagining Andy and imagining his friends. And there were a few things that I wanted to really lean into. I think it's a sad fact, but I know it from the amount of work that I've put in the world over the last 10 years, that when a woman is writing about her own experiences and particularly her emotional processes, we tend culturally as audiences to be kind of intolerant of that and unsympathetic of that. And I wanted to kind of do a sort of test to see, well, how would people feel if I lent into the desperation and the comedy of that and the exasperation of that and the patheticness of that? If I did that with a male character, would we be more tolerant of that? I think we have been. I think it would be a different book if it were Jen telling the whole story. So I was interested in that side of things. And I was really interested in Andy, like what makes heartbreak so unbearable for different types of people. And I knew that Andy was someone who found it really, really hard. And something that I think makes it so, ending relationships makes it so, what's so difficult for Andy is he's a nostalgist. You know, he's nostalgic and romantic. He's nostalgic about music. He's nostalgic about his own friendships. And he's incredibly nostalgic about his romantic relationships. And I was interested in how much that sort of romanticism and that rose lensing of relationships in the wake of a heartbreak, how much that holds us back and how insane that can make us.
It's also set against the backdrop of the world of stand-up comedy, which is very unique. It's very specific. Tell me a little bit about what you learned about stand-up comedy.
I'm so interested in that world. I think it's a very brave job. There's a lot in the book about that's exploring ego and how much ego is in attendance in the wake of a breakup and in heartbreak. There's no job that I can think of that is more vulnerable and is more entangled with a sense of ego than standing up on stage every night in front of a room of strangers and asking them to like you and find you funny. I had like a comedy consultant who's a good friend of mine, and he's a stand-up, and he answered all my questions, and I did lots of interviews with him. I think, you know, I always knew what a vulnerable job it is. I think I learned lots of specific things about the etiquette from comedians to other comedians and the atmosphere backstage. I learned that I definitely never want to. I mean, I did try stand-up. I did 2 whole gigs, you know, 12 years ago.
And what happened during those gigs.
So bad. It was so bad.
You're listening to Dolly Alterton on The Richard Crouch Show. Her new novel, Good Material, is available wherever you buy fine books.
It was so, so bad. And I like, there was one that I did. One of them was in like a comedy duo, and the other one, it was me flying solo. Both as terrible as each other. All I will say is that one of them consisted of me dressing up in a dinosaur outfit. And that noise that you just made is three times as more noise than the audience made when I performed the sketch. And in terms of Andy being a kind of, it's interesting you say that about him being like not a very good stand-up, because I never made that clear in the.
I get the vibe of it.
That's exactly what I wanted people to get the vibe on.
Yeah, yeah. I got the vibe that he wasn't terrible.
Yeah.
Good for a Wednesday night. He's good for a Wednesday night, exactly. You know, as long as the drinks are cheap.
He's totally. Safe. Yeah. He's safe. And I think that's the thing that, like, what I wanted people to get, the readers to understand what's in between the lines when they're reading it, is like, this isn't a comedian that you would remember, because this is not a comedian who's taken any risks. This is not a comedian who is challenging himself at all, or trying to like stay in touch with something of like the ever-changing organism that is the comedy industry. Like, he's not keeping up with that at all. He's just kind of set in his ways, and he's not reflecting at all on what that is. He's just complaining about what he's not and how he's treated. And there was something of that that I thought readers would understand, maybe was a clue to why his girlfriend was getting so frustrated with him, not only just with his career, but how he was as a man.
And as you've written a character like Andy, I think about yet another quote from you, where you talk about how people these days, it seems, only want to engage with fictional characters because of how likable they might be, rather than having these characters that are complicated and sort of have a lot of nuance to them. And perhaps Andy's that guy. He's not offensive.
No.
But he's just kind of mushy, maybe. He's not really anything in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And I don't know. Perhaps the lack of nuance is what makes him kind of not a great stand-up comic, and sort of someone who might not be terribly interesting to spend an evening with at the pub.
Yeah. And also, I saw him. I know that authors always pretend that they don't read their Goodreads reviews. I do. I saw a really, really good Goodreads review the other day, where there has obviously been that conversation on Goodreads, as there is with every book. It's just a moment we're in culturally of how likable or unlikable this person is. And a lot of chat about, you know, he's so insufferable and he's so excruciatingly self-pitying, and him in heartbreak is such a painful thing to read. And then a girl wrote this review that I was like, I literally want to print this and put it up on my wall, where she said, I really found Andy very unlikable, and he was making a lot of bad decisions. And I got really impatient with him, and he was really frustrating. And it was like, dot, 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 TBH, I think I didn't like him because he really reminded me of myself. Wow. And I was like, yes, this is what I want. Like, this didn't happen by accident. I didn't accidentally write a character who you don't want to go to brunch with every day. Like, remember what we're like in heartbreak. Remember how that presents itself. Yeah. None of us escape it. We all become self-pitying and childlike and obsessive. And what is the point of books like this if it is not to reflect how we've seen, witnessed human behavior firsthand?
That was Dolly Alterton on The Richard Crouch Show. Her new book, Good Material, is already a bestseller, and it's available now wherever fine books are sold. My guest in this segment is Alan Frew, the Scottish-Canadian singer, songwriter, actor, and author, and notably lead singer of the Canadian rock band Glass Tiger. You know them from their chart-topping songs like Don't Forget Me When I'm Gone and Someday. Here's Alan Frew. Thanks for taking some time to speak to me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. When I heard you were going to speak with me, I was thrilled.
Oh, well, thank you so much. In early bands that you were in, you must have played cover songs. But from what I've read about you, I'm guessing that there was probably more like The Who and Led Zeppelin and The Stones and things like that, rather than some of the stuff that you'd be covering on your new tour.
You're absolutely right. I grew up with The Beatles and The Who and you know, Zeppelin and all those kind of things. And the first band I was in was very much sort of like that. But I started to notice, you know, there was absolutely certain things that just didn't suit my voice. Especially this sort of American rock and roll. So I dabbled a lot with The Beatles and The Who and whatnot. But then when that fragmented and ended, mainly because of finances, everybody was broke and starving. when the second batch came along, which is a band called Tokyo that eventually becomes Glass Tiger, it started out very much the same. The drummer, the original drummer, Michael Hansen, he was all about Def Leppard and Rush and heavy rock. And I would actually only sing the sort of UK stuff, which by this time was early U2, early Police, early Simple Minds. And then I would leave the stage and go stand at the bar and have a pint while it was ridiculous. Anyway, I had a chat with him and I said, look, if you want me to be your front man, I think it's ridiculous that I leave the stage. And I think we have to phase out these heavier things and start focusing more UK. So that's why the 80s became easier, because our cover songs were by bands that I'm now going to cover again in 2024. You know, it's incredible.
You mention the 1980s and you call it a genre. The songwriting, I have to say, I think was exemplary.
You're so spot on. I think when we call the 80s a genre and we close our eyes, we focus on a real sort of particular part of it, which is that synthesized pop sound that was the part that came from sort of from nowhere. Here it is, this new this new take on music. But it was very forgiving in the fact that it allowed these other, as you mentioned, what I noticed was that the 90s then picked up on that and sort of refined it even a little bit more, and all of a sudden let grunge in the door. And now you could go anywhere from Glass Tiger to REM to Pearl Jam, you know, and it was all part of the same scene. And I think to me, when I close my eyes and think of the 80s, it's easier to pinpoint what I think the genre was, whereas the 90s is a much more sort of eclectic movement in my mind anyway.
You're listening to Glass Tiger's Alan Frew on The Richard Krause Show.
I love the fact that, you know, there were so many avenues to attend and listen to in music when you turn your radio on or you watch much music or, you know, whatever it is where you were getting your music from. But I do think they've become, I don't know how you feel about it, but I do feel there's a classic element to it now that will allow it to survive quite a bit longer, I think.
I think it's become the new classic rock.
Yeah.
I think when I listen to these songs, and I'm not involved in the music industry, nor was I certainly back then, but it felt like it was a little bit more fun maybe than it is now. Does that ring true to you?
Absolutely. And you know, I'm not under any, false illusions of grandeur in any way. I realize that, you know, when I come out and do this, I can only hope that people respect me as a vocalist.
What do you do to look after your voice? It's difficult, to keep those high notes. It's difficult to stay as we age, and we're all aging. So what do you do to look after your voice?
My friend, nothing.
Really?
I maybe go to the occasional Guinness. The only thing that stops me being who I am as a vocalist would be some, you know, a little flu, a little cold, whatever. Right. Other than that, I mean, on the day of the event, I'm very focused. I warm up in the morning. I warm up in the afternoon. I warm up just before I hit the stage. When I'm actually performing night after night after night, that's actually a good thing for me, because as long as I'm healthy, the voice is there. So I'm one of the fortunate ones so far. I've ran into a few in my time. First one that comes to mind is Paul Rogers. Mm. Paul was, he's older than I am, and he was right at the top of his game. I have witnessed some who have been out there. They can remain nameless, but they just couldn't cut it anymore. And I felt for them. But I'm one of the fortunate ones right now that my voice is still, you know, where it should be.
And you mentioned, you know, as long as you have your health, I mean, I think that that's something that probably was reinforced in you as you recovered from your stroke from a number of years ago. The last time I saw you, we talked about it at length, but you mm-hmm. seem to have recovered completely and are in tip-top shape after that, which is amazing.
As tip-top shape as you can be, being a stroke survivor at my age, I still carry scars from it. I had an incident that caused me to fall, and I broke my neck. I don't know if you know that.
No.
I broke my neck 10 days before going on a national tour, Glass Tiger and Corey Hart, and had major surgery to put a little piece of titanium plate into my spine, in my neck, and was on that stage and did that tour right across Canada. The surgeon came in. It was a gentleman from Iran, and he came in and he said, "I hear you say you go on tour." And I said, "Yeah." He goes, "You crazy." And he ran out of the room, and he signed off on me saying he wanted nothing to do with it.
Wow. Wow. Well, yeah. But you seem to have weathered that storm as well.
Yeah. And I'm from Glasgow.
Yeah. Well, I've heard you talk about the town that you're from, because mm-hmm. it's not Glasgow. It's just outside of Glasgow. And Glasgow has a reputation of yes. being tough. And I heard you say one time that yeah. people from Glasgow were even kind of afraid of the people that you grew up with.
Town I come from, even people from Glasgow never came in to mess with them, because it was off the charts. A wee town called Cote Bridge. That was the name of it.
Yeah. That was Alan Frew on The Richard Krause Show. A big thanks to Alan for stopping by and sharing some stories with us. They'll be doing Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead at the CAA Theatre in Toronto until April 6th. A big thanks to them, and a big thanks to Dolly Alterton for stopping by to tell us all about her book, Good Material, available now wherever fine books are sold. Of course, as always, my biggest thanks goes to you for listening. I'm Richard Krause. Stay healthy, stay happy, stay safe, stay weird, and we'll talk to you again soon.